Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May. I am joined by Michael Buzzy, Randy Olson, and special guest Dr. Jenny Jin of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, also known as the DPAA. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Jin.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our honor. So, a little bit about this show before we begin. This show is called The Duty to Remember, Identifying POW-MIA from the Korean War. Dr. Jin is a forensic anthropologist with the DPAA. She'll be talking about that briefly in a few minutes. And the work that Dr. Jin has done involves identifying hundreds of missing U.S. service members who fought in the Korean War. And in this show, we're going to be focused on two specific, quite recent identifications from the Korean War. Both of these individuals are from Michigan. The first is Private First Class John Shalemba from Hamtramck, Michigan, and then Sergeant First Class Jesse or Johnny Hill, who's from Highland Park, Michigan. Although both of these individuals went missing during the Korean War, and both were accounted for recently, their stories are quite different, and we hope to get that information out to you. I also want to say that this podcast is part of a series that we began in connection with POW-MIA Recognition Day, which is on September 18th of this year. And there are a variety of other shows at our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com and also at dutytoremember.com. So we encourage you to check out those resources. And I also would just like to acknowledge Lieutenant Colonel Tamara Fisher Carter for helping to coordinate this podcast with Dr. Jin. So Dr. Jin is, you are based in Honolulu, correct, at the Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam Laboratory?
Yes.
Okay. And so can you just briefly describe the mission of the DPAA?
So we are the only government, authorized government agency that can recover and identify the missing U.S. Service members from all past conflicts going back to World War II. So in the current form, we went through reorganization and merged with three different agencies merged together to become what is known as the DPAA in 2015.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of those organizations is known as JPAC, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, great. And so your work, can you talk about, and this is a sort of huge global operation, and you mentioned recover, and so there's recovery involved. And can you talk about how your work in particular fits into this mission of the DPAA?
Yep, so DPAA has, we are looking all together, more than 80,000 service members still missing from all different conflicts. So for us to make our mission most efficient, at least in the laboratory, so we have, as you said, recovery part, and then once the remains come into the lab, that's where I am, I work at. So in laboratory, we have it broken down into different projects based on different wars or battles. Mm-hmm. So, for example, World War II, because the casualty is still quite large and the number of missing is still quite large. So mm-hmm. we cannot look at World War II together, all together. So in that particular conflict is broken down into different battles, like Battle of Tarawa and USS Oklahoma and that kind of projects. But Korean War, we're still missing about slightly over 7,500 service members from the Korean War. So it's a fairly large number, but we can still deal with all that casualty at the same time. So that's the Korean War Identification Project that I've been leading for about 10 years now.
Wow. And we will we'll plant the seed now. We will talk about the different paths that identifications can take and the different ways that the remains do get to the lab. But yes, we'll be talking about these identifications recently from the Korean War. And later, we'll talk about the South Korean counterpart. So I know that there is, a kind of equivalent entity in South Korea, which accounts for the missing. But can you talk about other countries which may be, totally opposite in their policies of how they account for the missing?
So it's actually very unique to the United States that we have a large government agency that takes care of their missing. So, for example, like the most European countries, the UK and the France, for example, their tradition has been, to leave the fallen service members where they fell. And that's probably for various reasons throughout long history. That was how they dealt with that. And that's how we dealt with that until the Civil War. So it was actually towards the end of 1800s that the United States enacted all different laws to make the country responsible to go find the missing service members who fought for the country. So that's our unique part of our mission for the United States. But South Korean government started benchmarking us in the late 2000s. But we'll talk about that later. But so we are quite unique. Australia has a small branch that takes care of the missing, but it's nothing to the extent that we do.
And I remember reading somewhere that the work that came out of the Civil War was really led by families, and in particular women whose sons and husbands were unaccounted for, and they were sort of demanding. Is that your understanding?
Yes. There's a great book written by Dr. Faust about this issue. But yes, so that was led by the families who were frustrated because it's a big country, right? So we are a big country. So when their sons or brothers, husbands went missing, they really didn't have the means to go find them unless you come from money. A lot of people couldn't afford to go find them. So that was the movement led by the family to enact, especially after the conscription bill passed.
So that's I think the book that you're referring to is The Republic of Suffering, Drew Gilpin Faust. Yeah, that's where I read that. And so that's so important because, as we have discussed on this show, the Vietnam War sort of made us, sort of evolved us even further in that commitment, and the National League of Families. We've addressed that in several shows on this podcast. And so I just think that's a really important piece to understand, that it's really the work of families, civilians, who is pushing the government to perhaps be like more humane and, humanizing the state, as we have said on the show, and wives, women in particular. So I just, again, want to acknowledge that piece of our history. And so you are a forensic anthropologist, and can you just describe what forensic anthropology is for people who have no idea?
So anthropology in general deals with the cultural aspects of what makes us unique, or also biological aspects of what makes human who we are. So we always look at the very big picture. That's where we do a lot of comparative studies across different cultures and also comparative studies between species that are closely related to us. But forensic anthropology is a small branch, a more applied branch of biological anthropology, specifically looking at different clues that human skeletal remains can provide to make a decision about, to make a call about the skeleton. So what we say is a biological profile. So it's like, how old was this person at death? Or what kind of trauma, or what was the sex of the person, what was the estimated height. So it's an applied medical legal field within anthropology.
And so how do you put that discipline to work in the Korean War Identification Project?
So most of the remains that we receive in the laboratory, they're all skeletonized. Sometimes we do see some soft tissue, but it's very minimal. So what can we tell from the skeleton? And oftentimes with, you know, great new TV shows, a lot of people say, don't you get DNA? And then that's how you make an ID. That's not, that's part of it, but that's not all of it. And that's not necessarily always the most efficient way. And that's where anthropology comes in. So when we look at the skeletons, we can estimate the age, sex, and height, different traumas from the skeleton that will give us a clue of who this person could be. So using biological profile, that's not always like perfect method. As we all know, there's no one perfect science method. So it comes with error, but we know that. So we try our best to use that information to narrow down the list of potential candidates of like who this person can be.
Right. And so when there is DNA analysis, is that done by a separate lab?
Yes, we take the DNA sample in our laboratory and we ship it to the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory located in Dover, Delaware.
I see.
That's where they actually do the DNA analysis and then make the comparison to the family reference samples of the missing soldiers.
Okay, great. So we're going to, in a moment, just transition to one of these identifications that you recently made, Private First Class John Shalemba of Hamtramck, Michigan, whose identification was announced in 2019. And I just want to make sure that on the line we have Michelle Vance. Is that you, Michelle, with us?
Oh, yes, I didn't want to interrupt. I called late. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, not at all. So thank you so much
for
being here, and I'm going to turn it over to you in a moment. Michelle Vance is one of the relatives of Private First Class John Shalemba. But before we do that, I just want to open it up to any of the other hosts on the line, and also to you, Michelle, if you have any questions for Dr. Jin, the sort of general description of the mission and what she does, what the lab does, et cetera. Any questions?
No, not at this point, no.
Okay. And Randy, do you have any questions?
No, so far, very cool. Ready to continue on.
Okay. And Michael?
Yeah, I would agree, just for the sake of, because what we're about to get into is really profound. So, yeah, I'd dedicate all the energy to that. Thank you, Randy.
Okay, great. So let's talk about Private First Class John Shalemba. And Michelle, I'm going to turn it over to you by just reminding everyone that he was from Hamtramck, Michigan. And we'll talk about sort of how he got here and the process of identification. And so, Michelle, I'm turning it over to you now. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Hope. I had first found out that I had an Uncle John 2 years ago. Kind of took me quite by surprise when I got in a phone call from the Army. It was really something to wrap my head around as far as there was no talk in our family at all about John. John is actually a half-uncle of mine. My grandfather had two sets of children with two different wives. So when John came along, I think what had happened is that they were just so grief-stricken that nobody ever talked about John's existence. When I've tried to do some researches on him, I've come up with I've come up to a wall. It's really hard to research this, but what I've seen online through the emails that you sent me, Hope, has kind of sparked a fire in me. I need to find out more about him. I want to find out more about him. I'd mentioned to you on the phone, I was surprised that kids would be interested in a story like this. Somebody, you know, that died over half a century ago. But I'm finding that, you know, this is a wonderful thing for him to be remembered by. And I want to find out more about him now, more so than when the Army first told me, because he's really quite a mystery to me. And the fact that nobody talked about it in the family. I am the youngest. I'm 63 years old at the end of this month. And I've got nobody to really talk to about this. Who was he? Everybody's deceased. I do have an older sister, but she is not able to help me in this regard. But when I asked her if she knew of this, she did not know of John either. Nobody in the family had talked about it. So it was really a hardship for the family. If I can take a minute, I will just read to you what I had posted on Facebook and what I had found out. My grandfather came over from Austria. That was his birthplace. It's hard to say where he came from, though, because the boundaries changed so much. But he came over shortly after World War One, and there's always a shroud of mystery behind my grandfather. And which stands to reason why there's a mystery behind John as well, because my aunt was just not willing to talk about it. I could see the pain in her face when she tried to tell me something years ago, but she never really elaborated to what had gone on. Okay, well, I'm going to start here. Grandpa, Uncle Johnny is coming home. We all get strange phone calls, many to lower your credit card interest rate, or to renew your car warranty. They can be quite bothersome. But the call I received 6 months ago, and that was when I posted this, was really hard to believe, much less wrap my head around. I came home, I got this phone call from the Department of Defense, POW MIA accounting. Apparently I had an Uncle John Shalimba, bravely fought during the Korean War. He entered Korea June of 1950 and was listed as MIA in July of 1950. Bodies had been recovered from battles, but Johnny's body was recovered with no identification. He went nameless and presumed dead in 1954. He spent 1954 to present day at Punchbowl Memorial Cemetery in Honolulu, Hawaii. The Army never gave up on their search, and with the help of modern-day forensics, they were able to positively identify my Uncle John Shalimba. So now in late June 2020, my Uncle John will be given full military honors and will be buried in Arlington National Cemetery. I have goosebumps. I am eternally grateful for the Department of Defense and the Army never gave up on its search. So, Grandpa, Uncle Johnny is finally coming home. Now, June of 2020, we were to bury him there in Arlington, but due to COVID, the cemetery was closed. I got a new date of August, but due to things going on in Washington, D.C., August didn't look like a good time to go, and the Army agreed with me. So we are postponing it yet again. We're looking at May of 2021, hoping that things will kind of settle down in that area so that we can properly bury him there. Mm-hmm. What had happened is, my grandfather had three children with one wife. That would be my grandmother passed away. he's going to works. For some reason, the children were taken away from my grandfather. They ended up in the custody of St. Vincent de Paul in Detroit, Michigan. I don't know what type of search my grandfather did, but this was back in the 20s. I guess it was about 1929, he remarried, and he had three more children, John being the first of those three. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until World War II, when my father entered the Navy, that he ran across my grandfather. I guess it was a search for records so that my father could enter the Navy. At that time, I assume, because my father is not here to let me know the story, I assume that he would have found out about his half-brother, John. He did find out about his half-brother, George, and his half-sister, Mary, who later on moved out to California. But it's a strange story. most people have nice, functional families, and I'm sorry to say that I have a very dysfunctional family because I can barely do a search on my father's side. I can go back several generations on my mother's side, but I just have this brick wall with my dad's side. But anyways, we find out we have a half-Uncle John. I definitely do want to do more research on this and get more information about him. Haven't been able to locate a picture. I do have pictures of my uncle, his brother, and sister. Have several pictures of them, but none whatsoever of John. He was born March 15th, 1931, and he enlisted in July or August 5th of 1948, which puts him at 17 years old. Mm-hmm. Now, I assume you have to have a parent sign a voucher to allow you to enlist that early, or that young, excuse me.
Does anybody on the
phone I'm wondering,
know about that from the...
Pardon me?
Dr. Jin, do you know, or Lieutenant Colonel Fisher Carter, do you have to get a voucher?
If you were below, I think, younger than 18, 17.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then almost exactly 2 years later, July 20th, he's listed as missing in action of 1950. Mm-hmm. So his life did not get a chance to start whatsoever. I don't know the reason behind wanting to enlist at that time. But that's about all I can tell you of John. I've just run into a brick wall with him, but I'm just eternally grateful for the Army to go that extra mile to bring him back. All we have proof of in the forensics on John was they made a determining factor of his clavicle bone. They were able to determine his approximate height, and the Army, when they presented me with a booklet here about him, asked me questions about my father and my other uncle, to kind of verify, could this have been a size? It's just average build, about 5'8", 5'9", and I said, yep, my dad was 5'9", so was his brother, roughly within an inch or so of each other. Dark brown hair, the eyes, and all of that, but no picture either, because I had assumed that the Army would have had a picture of him. I have pictures of my dad in his Navy uniform, but nothing of John. So it's almost as if, he's definitely a big mystery to me, because basically because I don't have a picture of him, I can't verify, is this really my uncle? They tell me it is. It fits the story that I got from my aunt, which was very, very limited, but it's a big mystery to me.
So can I jump in real quick?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Dr. Jin a question because, like, so we've gotten a bit of a biography. We have a story. So we have this picture of who John Shalimba is from the family side. I'm wondering, like, what's the procedure for, like, identifying a person on the forensic anthropology side?
So for this case, this is a punch bowl disinterment, just like a lot of hundreds of other skeletons that's coming out. So to give you an idea how complicated this was on our end, so right after the war, so the war ended in 1953, and in 1954, the two sides, the North Koreans and China on one side, and then the United Nations troop, the majority of which was the United States, we did the exchange of the bodies, and that happened in 1954. And so we received over 3,000 bodies back then, and all the bodies were shipped to a mortuary, a temporary mortuary located in Japan, which was very close, in the part of Japan that was very close to South Korea. Even during the war, we had a mortuary there to process all the bodies. So in 54, the anthropologists, just like myself and some other medical doctors, were there to identify these bodies that we received from the enemy forces. And back then, the main way of identifying was to use fingerprint, and we'll take fingerprint and then send it to FBI. So that's how we identified a lot of them. They went home in 54. But about 870 individuals could not be identified for various reasons, and they were all transferred to the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, which is also known as the Punch Bowl Cemetery here in Honolulu, Hawaii, and they were buried in this particular section. So that's where they have been, and Private First Class Shalimba was one of those 870 individuals. So from the family side, we've been getting a lot of inquiries about, can you please exhume this particular unknown grave, because I believe that's my brother, or I believe that's my uncle. And so we've been getting, we got a lot of requests like that, and we were doing one, so each, like, disinterment. So we will go, if we'll review the requests from the family, and if it looks legitimate, we will exhume the grave. And that started in 1999. And the reason it started after, let's say 54, it's like after 40 years, 50 years since the war, is because we really didn't have a way to move forward with these unknown remains. One thing I always emphasize to people is, you know, it's much easier to identify them in the 50s, even if, you know, the body, even if we didn't have DNA back then, it's still the body, and the preservation was pretty good. So there's a reason why these 870 individuals are buried as unknown, because something did not make sense. So that's always something to keep in mind with all the new technology and whatnot. When we exhume a grave, we run into the problem, like, oh, this was the problem, why they couldn't identify them back in the 50s. So that's what, but in 1999, we started to get some success in DNA. And people talk about DNA all the time these days, so that gives you the false idea that DNA has been around for a very long time. But it has been around not very long. And the actual application in the forensic world, meaning that has medical legal consequences, so that happened about 20 years ago. So that's in, 30 years. 30 years ago, and that's when we started exhuming. Okay, if we can do DNA, maybe we can exhume these unknowns and then do a DNA test and then see who they are. We can identify them. So that was the process. That was the thought behind the first exhumation about 20 plus years ago. And one thing we quickly learned was that first, the bones, the remains of these unknowns have been preserved really, really well, most of them. That's and then so that makes you think, oh, if we can do DNA, it should yield, right, because they look really perfect. But nothing. We could not get anything from DNA. And that really was puzzling because the remains that we received from other countries like Vietnam, the remains itself, when you look at them, they don't even look like human bone because it's so degraded. But we do have pretty good success rate. We did have back then too. So like looking at the bones that look so perfect and getting no DNA was very puzzling. So that's when we started doing a research to see how come, what happened to this DNA of these remains. And that's when we discovered that prior to the transfer of the bodies from Japan to Honolulu, the bodies have been processed in with various chemicals. For a lot of different reasons, to preserve the body and also to control different things. So that's how the body was shipped, which actually preserved the bones really well, but killed the organic materials within the bone. So it's almost like becoming a fossil. That's an easy analogy to think about. So now we don't have DNA and we have bones. So we did anthropological analysis, but just like Private First Class Shalemba, most people fall in this average category, right? That's why it's called an average, because most people have similar height, similar age. Very unfortunately, these guys missing from the Korean War, they were pretty young. They died between age of 18 and 23. I find it very tragic to lose that many young folks. But because of that, we couldn't really make an identification using anthropology. There were so many people missing with that same height and same age. So we couldn't move forward. And that's when we decided to do something, right? So the DNA laboratory, they started their own project to deal with the punch bowl remains to see if they can get some DNA. So now with the advance of DNA technology, like you probably heard the news, like Neanderthal genome have been sequenced. So Neanderthals have been around like 30,000 plus years ago. So if we can get DNA from remains that old, maybe there's a way to get DNA from these punch bowl remains, even if they were heavily treated with chemicals. So our DNA laboratory under the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System, so they launched a five-year project to come up with a way to get DNA out of the punch bowl remains. And at the same time, in the laboratory, that's when we developed the clavicle comparison method, because we discovered that 75% of the Korean War missing, they actually had their chest radiographs taken, and we actually have that for 75% of them, which was due to tuberculosis concern back then. So towards the end of World War II, it became mandatory for all the service members to take a chest radiograph. And, you know, they were not really using those radiographs for anything. So that's when we came up with this idea, if we can compare the clavicles and some of the vertebrae next to the clavicles, if we can compare those bones, take a radiograph of the bones from punch bowl, and then compare the antemortem chest radiographs to that, the remains, maybe there's a way forward. So we launched our own project, and it was a very rigorous project, because you cannot just say, oh, yeah, I see that. I see the similarity, so that must be him. It doesn't work that way, right? It actually has to be accepted in the larger scientific community, and also it has legal ramification. So we spent about 5+ years to develop and validate the method, publish it, to have that method accepted. So that was one of the clavicle methods that we used to identify Shalemba, just like what Michelle talked about, the clavicle. Yeah, that's the clavicle.
Yeah, I'm looking at the booklet now that the Army had given me. They show me a photograph of his skeletal remains and then a drawing of the skeletal remains. I had assumed there'd be barely anything coming back, being that he was under tank fire. But they have 95% of his remains. The skeletal drawing shows missing some fingers, his kneecaps. One clavicle would be his right side. And it's showing the skeletal, a picture of the skeletal remains laid out here with the missing clavicle. The booklet is just, some of it is a little bit hard to understand, but it's, you know, as I'm listening to you too, it's all making sense. But I was just simply amazed that, you know, how much that they did, you know, did have of him, if this is in fact him. But, I mean, they went as far as to say, you know, yes, he's of European descent. Yes, he is. You know, 18 to 22 years old, they figured he was. And, you know, it talks about the radiographs, like you just mentioned. My aunt did give, according to the Army, my aunt did offer a sample of DNA of her own back in 1980. And this was shortly after my grandfather had died. It was just too stressful for the family to go through all this. I'd seen some letters that the family had written to the Army. So I understand that it was really a traumatic thing to lose the boy, not know anything about, you know, his remains or where he was at. And basically the letter said, this has been too stressful. It's the stress has killed, you know, his mother has died of it, which would have been his, you know, his stepmother. But it just was so hard on the family. My grandfather had said, if anything happens, if you should find his remains, just bury him there. So I was happy to see that, you know, the Army has kept up on this. They want his remains brought back here to, you know, to America. And the whole time I'm thinking, yes, bring him back to the mainland. Well, here I'm finding out he was, you know, he was in Hawaii since 1954. So this has been quite a mystery that I want to continue with, though, to find out more about him. And, oh, heaven help me to eventually put a picture to his name, but I thank you for all you've done for other families, especially too. I mean, this is truly amazing how you can do all of this.
This case, I'm glad to hear that we could be part of this very honorable journey with you and your family. This identification was particularly difficult. So the question would be then, why was he not identified, right? Of the 3,000 bodies we received, we identified a lot of them, but why was he? So his unknown number, each unknown was shipped with an unknown number, X251 page on. So why was he not identified? That's because his loss was, he died very early on in the war. So the war broke out on June 25th of 1950, and the U.S. Forces back then stationed in Japan flew quickly to Korea within 2 days. So June 27th is when we got involved in the war. And he, we believe, went missing on July 14th. So it's within less than a month. And the one thing to remember is all the engagements that led to all these battles have been very, very chaotic, especially in the very beginning of the war, because we were not ready. We had no one actually predicted this war, not South Korea. So it happened Sunday night when most of the people were just sleeping. So this was completely unexpected, and we shipped our forces very quickly and to Korea. So you can imagine how chaotic this was for us, and while the North Koreans had everything ready. So during that chaos, it took us time to figure out how to document a lot of things, like who went missing, when. We actually have, I believe, the best record in the world when it comes to all these daily morning reports produced by the military every morning, documenting who went missing, where, that type of information, which South Koreans don't have. They don't have any of those. So that's what makes it very difficult for them to identify someone. But we have that record. But still, in the beginning, the record was not very good because we were not prepared. And then even with the high casualty in the beginning, we were not ready to deal with that yet. So his remains was actually recorded as his recovery location was wrongly documented to begin with. So after some research done by the Army, they figured, oh, this is not this unknown. So they had to swap that record. So that's the number one part. That's why it was complicated. And then number two, the remains, the body was found on July 14th, but Private First Class Shalemba was listed as missing on July 20th. So in the beginning, yeah, like, oh, he cannot be him, right? Because he was alive when the body was found. So that's when our historians dug deeper into this case and realized, like, that date of July 20 missing, that was a generic date that they picked for all the casualties, about 400 casualties from that area in the general time frame. So that was another thing that we had to do a lot of historical research to see if that was the case, to see who could this be. So that was, I read the historical memo again recently, and mm-hmm. that our historian, Dr. Jim Rose, he did a phenomenal job. It's like 15-page long analysis of why he thinks. So he narrowed it down from a pool of 389 unresolved casualties from that area based on the Korean villagers' testimony that was collected by our Army, our Army Grace Registration Service, when they were searching for more information. So Dr. Rose looked at all those information together, and then with the help of anthropologists and dentists, he was able to narrow it down to four individuals most likely for this particular unknown, one of which was Private First Class Shalemba. So to me, that amount of historical research that went in, we don't often talk about it because we focus on DNA and like science, all the cool things. But this was very important background research that was done to solve this case.
That's really interesting. And the announcement of the DPAA, I think they referred to that as, I remember seeing something like circumstantial evidence. So would that be this historical research that you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. So anybody with any follow-up questions?
No.
Not yet.
Michael?
Yeah, no, I've been utterly enthralled with this story. So, yeah, please continue.
Okay. So, Michelle, do you want to continue with the – I don't know if you have the outline, if you want to continue with the questions or
– I don't have the outline in front of me. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I had it on my phone. I'm sorry.
Okay. No problem. So I'll just ask – so, Dr. Jin, you said that the disinterment, that this happened because families were requesting it. I just want to make sure I understand. But because of recent developments in DNA and the clavicle comparison method, this is what prompted the disinterment of these 870 unknowns from the Korean War. Is that the process, or if not, can you correct me?
Yes, so it is correct. So for about since 1999 to 2018, so about 20 years, we did disinterments, individual disinterments, based on family requests, or sometimes if the historians have really good reason to believe this unknown is so-and-so, and that then we exhume that particular grave. But then the question, there have been requests by the family groups mostly, say, why don't you disinter all of them? So you don't have to review, like, one file per grave. So that was finally approved in July 2018. So by then, we had 652 unknowns left at the punch bowl in July 2018. So that was approved. So the approval was to disinter all the Korean War unknowns left at punch bowl. So we cannot just go and exhume all of them at once. So we broke them down into seven phases. And Private First Class Shelemba's case was in phase one. So his disinterment was up in October 2018, one of the very first unknowns that we exhumed. Oh. And we finished phase two, and we are about to start phase three disinterment. Wow.
Michelle, did you want to ask anything?
No, I'm just going wild. That's
Okay, so you still have a ways to go through these different phases. I see. And so it takes you about. So is there a number of remains in each phase?
Yes. So we carefully reviewed all 652 left to see what would be our best strategy to exhume them. So we looked at various things, like not all of the skeletons, the unknowns, have that many remains, like Private First Class Shelemba, like his almost complete skeleton, but some of them are not. The preservation's not very good. We know that because each unknown has what's called an X-file associated to it that was made back in the 50s to tell me what's in there. So we look at that also, and we look at also historical circumstances. If five bodies were found together, then it makes sense to exhume those five together, right? So that's how each phase has about 100 plus and minus unknowns planned for now.
Okay. Anybody? Nope. So, Dr. Jin, I mean, you're interacting with a family member on this podcast, and is that something you get to do a lot, or is that rare? And can you talk about how that? Oh, you don't get to do it very often.
No.
Wow.
Well, so considering how long ago this was, and I'm 63. I mean, there's probably a lot. Family members just aren't alive of other soldiers. This was so long ago.
Right. That's one of our main challenges. I always emphasize, like, we need to find the family member DNA. The Korean War has really good coverage. We have about 90% of the missing service members' family DNA on file, which is amazing. That's, again, something I'm just like, wow, because it's not a small country and you cannot just go and collect someone's DNA, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to do a lot of genealogy research, which is all done by the Army, the Service Casualty Office. That's the office that contacted you, Michelle. And yes. Big shout out to them, because when we started in the early 90s, started this mission to look for Korean War missing, we had like 3% of them had a DNA family reference sample, 3% of the service members. And then that for that number in the past 30 years to go from 3% to 90%, so we have about 7,000 service members do have their families donated their DNA for 7,000 service members. To me, that's amazing. I believe that's what make the United States so actually very exceptional in this endeavor. Without that, you can get DNA. DNA technology will advance, but you need to compare that to something, right? Because it doesn't tell you who that is. Mm. So since the goal for the service members and even DOD civilians like myself, we all gave DNA sample, which are stored at the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System. They don't do anything with it unless they have to. So that's like collecting what's called a self-reference to compare. So if something happens to me and they find remains that they believe that's mine, then I actually have my DNA to compare that to, which is the best method. But we don't have that for the Korean War missing, so we need family samples. And without family samples, we cannot make IDs. So this one was very fortunate, Private First Class Shalemba. We did not need DNA because he had very unique clavicle morphology, and density of the bone was very unique, and everything matched up. We also had good dental record that matched his dental record. So we had other but we need DNA for most other cases. DNA technology will advance, but as you said, Michelle, the families are aging. So we need to go and find as many family reference samples as possible before they pass away.
Mm-hmm.
So to go back to Hope, sorry, go ahead.
No, please, go carry on.
So the question, do I get to interact with families? No, because our job at DPAA, at least for the laboratory, it ends with the, so I will recommend an identification. So I believe this is Private First Class Shalemba based on X, Y, and Z reasons. And then if our medical examiner approves it, that's where my work ends. So I don't get to interact with families very often, but I love to hear the story. So I always, you know, Google to see what happened to the person we identified. So I'm truly, really happy right now to hear from Michelle. And this work is very personally and professionally fulfilling for me. So I'll share a short story of my family history, because my grandparents, their hometown is in North Korea, and they evacuated safely to South Korea during the war in December 1950 with the help of U.S. Navy. So when they arrived at a refugee camp in South Korea, my father was born there. So it always gives me goosebumps. And then, you know, I never paid attention to my grandfather's story as a kid. Like, yeah, that's another, like, war story. And then I started working at DPAA 10 years ago and learned more about the Korean War. And I was, like, looking at these casualties from that area and, like, wait a minute, is this the ship that my grandfather was on? So my grandfather is still, he built a successful life in South, and he's still well and living. He's 93 years old. So, and he's very proud of his granddaughter doing this work because when he left his hometown, he was 20 years old. So he was about the same age with Private First Class Shalemba and all these about 36,000 people, the U.S. service members who lost their lives in Korea. So it just, you know, it just went in full circle. And here I am leading the Korean War Identification Project. So it's professionally, I can use all the things that I learned as an anthropologist. It's professionally very fulfilling, but it's more than that to me. It really means, like Michelle, I thank you and thank your uncle Shalemba for helping my native country. I'm a naturalized U.S. citizen now, but my native country, my entire family is still in Korea. So, yeah, I want to share that story with you.
Well, thank you for all you do, because, like I said, this booklet I'm looking at the Army gave me, I mean, I'm just floored at all of the details they have here, all of the searches that they, you know, they documented all the searches that they had for him. They never gave up. And therefore I shouldn't give up. I don't want to give up. I got to put a face to this skeleton here. Mm-hmm. I got to put a face on it. And that's what disturbs me the most, because of the brick walls I've had. And maybe at some point, another point that, you know, Hope and I can talk about the way that I can go forward with this. Because I think I really need to put a face to this young man's body. The fact that, you know, none of us knew who he was, knew that he existed, and for what? I've got to do this. So I thank you too, Dr. Yep. Jen, all you do.
And, it's so meaningful, you know, for all of us on this call. I mean, there's many, many fragments are being connected in this show. And I just want to share also, Dr. Jen and Michelle, I've relayed this to you. You know, when we think of the work of the DPAA, you know, we do tend to think of, okay, this question, we're on this question about families and do you interact with families. And when we at Central Michigan University celebrated POW/MIA Recognition Day, it was consciously connected to Private First Class Shalemba. And the inspiration for that actually came from a trip that I had made to Margraten in the Netherlands, where my great uncle is buried. He fought in World War II. And I was the first family member to visit that grave, and there were flowers on it. And I was shocked. Who's at this grave leaving flowers? And I went into the office and queried, and they said, every grave is adopted by someone in Holland. And I said, but why? And they said, well, various reasons, and I can look up to see who adopted your great uncle. And it's called the Schutterij of Valkenburg, and it's kind of a town militia. But they do this to teach their children about the war. This is the way mm-hmm. that they educate. And I thought that is just so profound. And with the Korean War, Dr. Jen, I mean, I've been in your country of origin many times, in Namyangju, actually, and we've done many shows on the Korean War. As you know, it's the 70th anniversary of the mm-hmm. Korean War. And in the United States, it's the Forgotten War. And this is a way of, like, focusing on Private First Class Shalemba and Johnny Hill, who we'll get to in a moment, and sort of bringing to life these individuals and this incredible story about the identification and the different stories, as such, yeah, educationally powerful and rich. And so that's another mm-hmm. way that the work of the DPA is being used here, and that's, you know, why I reached out to Michelle. And so I'll just leave it open to see if anybody else wants to chime in about that.
I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. As I'm, you know, fundamentally ignorant about this, but I'm curious, is there an explicit connection between the League of Families and the DPAA, and during the procedures at the beginning that got the DPAA into the kind of government institution that it is now?
So that was in the very beginning, like right after the Vietnam War. So that's when, as Hope mentioned in the beginning, it's the family members, right, who became the National League of Family and constantly pushed the government to do this work. And so in the beginning, back then it was still high, and then we evolved to JPAC, and then to DPAA. So we were very tied together back then, but now we grew and legally we expanded beyond Vietnam War in the 90s. So they are a very important part of our mission, but we expanded our mission.
Mm-hmm.
beyond Vietnam?
Yeah, and let's really thank you for asking that question, Randy. Like, again, you know, this is a process of evolution, and it's really, you know, the sort of the stimulus is coming from loss of the families, and it goes all the way back to the, you know, after the Civil War, as we said. And so this is a process of evolution, and as I understand it, you know, Dr. Jin, you said that the DPAA is really unique. What the United States does is really unique, and I think that it's like a beacon that I think other countries sort of look at it with great respect, what we do, and we're, you know, I think teaching other countries in a way about this important, the importance of giving an accounting and not just forgetting families and
mm-hmm.
individuals. Yeah. Michael, did you want to ask anything or chime in?
I would just like to, for one, this whole show has been one of the most, I would say, resonant and profound experiences. Hope had brought me into this whole POW-MIA fold in late August, and I worked with her and the other various military-affiliated organizations on Central Michigan University to help put on this POW, Central Michigan University's first recognition of POW-MIA Recognition Day. And Michelle, through that process, that's where I first heard about your uncle, and then through continuing to talk with Hope, that she found out more information, I came to learn more and more. And it was truly, it was a story that struck a chord with me personally. It was one that I felt has embedded itself into the fiber of my being. It was, because in many ways I relate to his like life experience. You know, he was either like 17 or 19 when he ended up going missing. That is the age I am currently. So there's that connection. And as you said, he came from a dysfunctional family life, and that's something I can relate to as well. And I've always been really interested in, you know, the history side of the war and stuff. And so through the process of undergoing what you have done as well, Michelle, I was very intrigued, like, you know, that drive to want to see a face, like to just connect a face to an individual that, you know, I've read the articles from when he was finally accounted for in September of 2019. And I was on the Hamtramck High School alumni website going back through to see, like, okay, did he graduate? Like, is this where he attended? Because I'm also a Metro Detroiter, so I come from those same stomping grounds. And just that, like, resonant connection was so huge. And I think Hope's, when she was talking about that education piece, and truly it was through such an individualistic story that I was able to gain so much knowledge about this process, what the DPAA was, and the amazing work you do, Dr. Jin, and the history and what I've gained from, you know, help to putting on this recognition for Central Michigan University, and then continuously being able to engage with really amazing individuals such as yourself, that it is a history that continues to unfold and evolve, and I find it all the more resonant. And definitely this show, I would say, for me personally, is like a keystone that has connected all of these pieces. And Dr. Jin, when you were sharing your story of, you know, how your family has sort of this tie to the Korean War, and that their hometown was in North Korea, and then it was through the actions of U.S. military members that then your family was able to make it to the South, and then, you know, Michelle's family history as well on the military aspect. Like, it's all connected, and I find it so personal, and it rings so deep within myself, and I am so grateful to have learned so much from this experience.
Wow. That's really something. I mean, when I first heard this, I mean, like I said, it was just so hard to wrap my head around it. I was in disbelief for one thing, but some things kind of re-triggered into my head that, you know, this could in fact be my uncle. Not knowing I had a relative, I mean, how am I to feel about this? I have no real connection with him. I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, not a loving person, but it's hard to fathom sometimes, and, you know, but I look at this book and it's, oh my God, you know, so I do want to get to the bottom of more of this. I want to find out more about him, but every time I do a search, I'll get bits and pieces of information. And sometimes, I've gone on Ancestry myself and they list names and I said, oh, I don't know if this is one that's correct or not. I can, like I said before, I can go back several generations for my mother's side, but I get to my grandfather and then that's kind of it. I realize the borders change a lot in Europe. Mentioned one relative. I could have another branch of the family in Cincinnati, Ohio, but I'm unclear about that. But I mean, it's just amazing some of the pieces that I have picked up along the way. But I'm the only one that really cares about this in my family. Like I said, I have an older sister, but she's incapable of understanding what I'm going through with this, and it's quite a puzzle that I'd like to put all the pieces together. I want to put a face to this young man. I want to finish his name. When they told me that he did qualify for Arlington Cemetery, knowing full well that we have two cemeteries right here in Michigan, I felt that he would be best honored there with his brothers in Washington, D.C. A lot of people go to cemeteries, just like Hope, you said you found flowers on your uncles there. People go to cemeteries. They honor those fallen. And even though that we have two here in Michigan, I don't know how often I would go or my sister would go, but I know other people would go to Arlington. I mean, I'm sure people will go to the Michigan cemeteries as well and stuff, but the more I read about Arlington, it's quite an honor. I feel that it's fitting for him. I mean, he gave his life so young. He didn't have a chance to start his life, and I don't want to get critical, but I'm thinking what kind of training did he get? And I think with that war, I think they threw the kids in too fast. Maybe didn't have enough training, and a lot of things could very well have happened that might not have happened had they had adequate training or knew a little bit about the terrain there or whatever. I'm just grasping at things. I'm not being accusatory in any way, but this poor young man had no shot at life. And in eternity, I'd like to see him be remembered. So.
So one of the cool things that we do frequently on this show is we look very closely at individual stories, untold stories, in order to extract the maximum amount possible of moral energy that we can from them. And this is a good example where, this is a person who basically no one knows anything about. And the closer we look, the more information we find and the richer the story becomes, despite the fact that it was like just a blank question mark for half a century.
Mm-hmm.
And it unveils something very critical, something that's overlooked as far as I'm concerned, that, at bedrock, our civilization is built on this idea of the infinite or near or practically infinite value of the individual. And so even somebody who's basically forgotten, thought to be lost, dead overseas, still, half a century later, can provide overwhelming amounts of meaning to individuals. And it's like, it's so obvious. Like, we're all feeling it right now. And so, I'm curious to learn more. I'm interested to find out if we can actually locate some information about Private First Class John Shalemba and, just see how far we can take it, because, the more we learn, the deeper it gets, and the deeper it gets, the better it is.
Yes, as I said before, yeah. fragmentation, one of my favorite quotes is from E.M. Forster, only connect, live in fragments no longer. And yeah, as these identifications are made, you're ending fragmentation. There's some some family therapists talk about the myth of closure, but there's some process, there's some, you know, movement in dealing with loss. I think in Michelle's case, your case is so, maybe atypical for the sort of what we would think would happen when a family member is identified, where we're imagining, you know, as you said, you know, a more functional family and so forth. But I want to say we're at like, we've been going for an hour, and Dr. Jin, I know that you're very, very busy, and we thank you so much for spending time with us. I just want to see if it's okay if we continue, or should we come back some other time to talk about the other issues, Johnny Hill and the other issues that we were supposed to talk about. How do you feel about it?
I can do it either way.
Okay. So I think it's actually a natural place to sort of end with this John Chalumba's case, because I think going into Johnny Hill should take, you know, probably another hour. So I think that, you know, we should perhaps come back hopefully sometime soon and continue this conversation. So I will make that decision. And we always sort of go around before we end our shows and get, you know, sort of summary comments from the participants. So I will start with you, Michael. Do you have anything to close out with?
Yeah, I would just like to say I have extended an immense amount of gratitude and thanks to Dr. Jin and all of the work you've done, and then to you as well, Michelle, for your fortitude and your courage and your drive to continue to work to put a faith to this individual that we've been discussing and to come to understand more about him. And then for once too, again, Dr. Jin, for continuing to bring these individuals back to life and connecting them with their families. I think it's been an amazing hour. I thank you both for participating.
Thanks. Michelle?
Thank you.
Well, I feel pretty much the same way this young man just mentioned. I'm very grateful that the Army has never given up on the young men, the young soldiers from the Korean War. I'm still trying to understand all of this myself, and it's amazing what's being done about this. I'm very grateful to the Army and Dr. Jin, all that you've done. I thank you. I thank you very much.
And Michael?
Well, I already went, Hope.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Randy, sorry.
The main thing that I feel compelled to say is that, you know, putting a face to Private First Class John Chalumba is, you know, it's doing something more than just appeasing our curiosity. It's doing something more than just putting a face to another person. There's like a fundamental thing. It's like we're putting the universe together and putting things into order, at least a little bit. And I don't know, there's something about that that's just supremely valuable. I don't have any other way to say it. So I really thank everyone who's here for their role in that, you know, slight reorganization of the cosmos, and only connect. Yeah.
Thanks. And Dr. Jin, do you want to say anything?
Yeah, I would like to thank you for inviting me. This is really great. And I want to emphasize that my wonderful team of 16 analysts, they are working really hard to get as many identifications as possible Right now, I think we've been so busy even during the pandemic. I keep all of them very busy. We know that the families are aging and we know time is our enemy. So we just, yeah, we're doing our best and we have not forgotten about any of you.
Thank you. And Lieutenant Colonel Fisher Carter, would you like to say anything before we close out?
Also, just thank you for Dr. Jin and her team and the dedication that they go in with daily, committed to DPAA's mission and providing the fullest possible accounting of our missing personnel to their families and the nation, as well as you, Dr. May, for your interest in helping us to speak to this today, and Ms. Michelle for sharing that personal story with everyone. And that's it. Just a gratitude of thanks. It's an honor to work with her and to have been present on the call today.
Yes, and I'll just repeat the sentiment. Humbled, honored, grateful, in awe of the story, and it's a very long and both painful and beautiful at parts story. We've been focused on the Korean War in this show, but our Duty to Remember series was really focused on the Vietnam War, and as Randy mentioned, you know, the role played by the National League of Families, and in particular by Evelyn Grubb, who was the national coordinator for a number of years, whose husband, Nuke Grubb, was shot down in North Vietnam while he was flying his reconnaissance plane. That story is another very rich and profound story, and this show is fortuitously close to Veterans Day, and we're going into Veterans Day weekend, and I want to acknowledge that it's very big. It's the Korean War, it's the Vietnam War, it's these individuals who went lost, and again, to emphasize like the role of families and women and pushing our country a little bit closer to a more humane plane. Hopefully we will be back talking about this other identification that Dr. Jin's team recently made, and that would be Sergeant First Class Johnny Hill. I've mentioned he's from Highland Park, Michigan, and the circumstances of his journey to the United States are very different than Private First Class Shalemba's, and that's why we wanted to bring them both together in a show, but time is not on our side with that, so we hope to be back. I also want to announce, since we've done a number of shows with the filmmakers from Napkin Sketch Productions and their wonderful documentary Fruits of Peace, which also features Arlington Cemetery very prominently in this story of reconciliation between the anti-aircraft unit C-4 in North Vietnam and one of the pilots that was shot down. I've mentioned him, Newland Grubb. It's an incredible story. And this weekend, actually Saturday evening, you can watch the Fruits of Peace documentary for free, and as well as a discussion with the filmmakers at the John Steinbeck Center. There's a link to that on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. You'll see a number of show resources, including articles about Dr. Jin's work and other related materials. But at the very end, you'll see this link to registration if you're interested in that. And again, it's another incredible story about individuals and finding meaning after all of these years and heartbreak. So you've been listening to Virtues of Peace. We hope to be back soon. And God bless and have a safe weekend. Bye, everyone.